Open your Bibles to Habakkuk chapter 1 tonight. Last week we went down through verse 11. In Habakkuk chapter 1, if you remember, Habakkuk introduces this prophecy. We saw in verse 1, it's an oracle, most of your modern Bibles say, but that word oracle meaning literally a burden. It was a heavy weight for him because it was a hard thing. And then that comes down to that his problem, the reason he gets his prophecy, is he is really crying out to God, saying, God, why do you allow this to happen? Why do you allow all this injustice in our nation? Why do you allow all the people in my country to treat each other in this manner? And so as a result of that, verse 5, one of the key verses for this book, God says, look among the nations and observe, be astonished and wonder, because I am doing something in your day that you would not believe if you were told. And what he's going to do then, and he delineates after that, is that he's going to bring the Chaldeans. We often refer to these as the Babylonians. The Chaldeans lived in Babylonia, which got its name from Babel and from the city of Babylon, which then ended up being a rebuilt city after God judged the nations at Babel. And the Chaldeans were people of the north, if you remember, that had moved down and settled in Babylon. And remember, Chaldeans meant that they were stargazers. So they were people that studied the stars primarily because that was the way they worshipped gods. They looked at those stars as representing gods, and so they tried to tell times and everything like this. Tell times in terms of, is this a good time for me to go off and buy this? Is this a good time for me to marry? You know, it's not, is this a good time to plant? You know, it's like the Egyptians knew when Sirius showed up in the sky, that it was just a matter of counting off a certain number of days from that was their season, their planting season started. So so there were things like that went on with their stargazing. But we're talking about making determinations based on the stars for your life. Okay. And that's what these Chaldeans were. But the Chaldeans then had a reputation for being absolutely vicious people in the way they attacked. We've already seen, as we were looking in previous studies, such as in Nahum, where we saw the destruction of Nineveh, that God was going to use the Medes and the Chaldeans to destroy Nineveh. But he talks primarily about the Babylonians, and there are the Chaldeans. And so this is the group of people. And so think about your Habakkuk. You're going to God going, I look at my nation is in a terrible state. Nobody in my country, nobody in my nation is doing the right thing. They're all disregarding the law. They twist and they pervert justice all over the place. How can you look at this, God? And then God says, okay, here's what's going to happen, Habakkuk. I'm going to bring the Chaldeans against you. And they're fierce people. And if you didn't see it, you wouldn't believe this. And Habakkuk is taken aback, which brings us then tonight down to verse 12. Where with that as a background then, Habakkuk says, are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We will not die. You, O Lord, have appointed them, referring to the Chaldeans, to judge. You, O Rock, have established them to correct. So he looks at this at the beginning of this, and the first thing he says, okay, I know who you are. Now again, this is a good point for us just to make a pitch here for you having a good solid theology. And when I'm saying theology now, I'm talking about doctrine of God. While you can still breathe well, while there's not a lot of pressure on you, you need to take the opportunity to learn who God is, according to his word, and get those facts solidified in your mind. Because every one of you, there's not a one of us that's going to be immune to this, every one of you are going to have the world at times come crashing down around us in ways that you probably wouldn't really expect. it's kind of like you're always, yeah, I know that that'll be hard or things like that. And, oh, that's good, but that's going to be off of the distance. But you don't realize how hard it is till you actually go through it. And you go, wow, that is way harder than I could ever have imagined that this was going to be. And if I did not have a solid understanding of who God was coming into this, this would be a hard time for me to learn now. Because I can't hardly keep my mind straight from one moment to the next to try to learn something new. And so Habakkuk has a knowledge of who God is here. He knows that he is a God that is from everlasting. He knows that he is Jehovah, that is the living one. You realize, and I was thinking about this over a month or so ago when I was studying for speaking someplace else, that name Jehovah was the name, remember, that God had given to Moses. And you realize that you and I look at it and we say Jehovah. It's translated in your Bibles, Lord, for certain reasons, which we're not going to get into right now. But you realize when they said that, what they were saying, every time they said that, essentially they're saying, the one who is. You imagine if that was your name? See, years ago, people used to name names with significance. My mom and dad called me Timothy. You know what? My mom and dad didn't know what Timothy meant. It was one of the names. It was going to be Philip or Timothy. They chose Timothy. You know what Timothy means? Honors God. They didn't choose it because it said honors God. Because my parents didn't get into what does a name mean. They chose a name because they liked the way it sounded. So my name's Timothy. My sister's name's Chris. My other sister's name's Allison. Because they liked the names. So that's all it comes down to. But there was a time in which people's names were given with a lot of concern or consideration for what it represented. In fact, if you go back to some of the early days of our country, especially among the Puritans, and you go through cemeteries, there are people. I've read about these things. There are people that their parents named them entire verses right out of the Old Testament. They have names that are like 8 and 10 words long. Like, how you like having the name that God is the one who stands and he is over for us or stands over for us. But there are people that name stuff like that. That's when they name their kids. So even as recent as the history of our country, there were people that gave names because they saw significance in those names and they had a hope tied to that name for these people. Well, when God gave his name to Moses, he gave him the name Jehovah. Jehovah, remember, means it's based on the Hebrew word meaning to be or to exist. And it's in a form of it meaning God is the one who is. It's not the God who was, and it's not the God who will be. It's the God who is. He's always an is God. Because he's unchanging in that. So could you imagine that? If every time you said his name, you were thinking, let's go pray to the one who is. Let's pray to the one who exists. Oh, thou Father, the one who exists. I mean, this is the kind of thing that they would say. You and I miss this when we talk to God. We call him Father, which is, there's nothing wrong with doing that, addressing him as that. But when they addressed him as Jehovah, which Habakkuk does, he said, you're the one who exists. And then we have so the one who exists, my God, my Holy One. We've talked about this at different times in theology proper. What do we mean when we say God is holy? For most people, they immediately run to the fact God is set apart from evil. Okay. If that's true, ultimately that means that holiness is what we would call a relative attribute. Relative meaning it has to be related to something to exist. Because in eternity past, was there any evil for God to be separated from? No. There wasn't any evil for him to be separated from. So to define holiness as being separated from evil really doesn't work. That gives it a temporal thing related to a temporal quality that exists. What we're really talking about when we say that God is holy is we're saying that there is no conflict within God. There's no conflict between the persons of the Godhead, but there's also no conflict within God and his character. And again, every one of us in here knows what it's like to be in conflict. you know what it's like to want to do this, and I want to do this. I'll just share a brief story. I had a little thing that's happened over the last few days in which I ended up having to deal with a situation that deals with some of my brothers who aren't getting along. And I always wrestle with this thing about they're in God's hands, and I'm supposed to keep my nose out of it to some degree. But at the same time, Galatians 6:1, if you're spiritual and you see a brother caught in a trespass, and part of the trespass is defined at the end of Galatians 5, has to do with biting at one another or being hostile towards one another, then if that's the trespass, and if I observe that, and I'm spiritual, am I supposed to try to restore them? And I have avoided doing that. I've avoided doing that for a long time because I don't want to do this, because that's uncomfortable. How many of you like to get into conflict? How many of you like to confront other people? Raise your hand. No one wants to, none of us like conflict.
If I'm carnal, I do.
Yeah. If I'm carnal, yeah. And that's one of the reasons I'll be real honest, Ben. That's one of the reasons I'm hesitant about even ever doing anything like this, is because I know I can fly off the handle really easy. I can feel as I'm talking to someone, I can feel my heart rate coming up. I can feel the pressure in here. I can feel the inside that just wants to. But if I remember what Jim, and I remind myself of this a lot after Jim went over this, where we were talking about that passage in Ephesians 4:26, where he says, be angry, but don't sin. And there's an imperative. That be angry is an imperative, but it's a passive imperative. And what we call it is, we call it an imperative of concession. Go ahead, be angry, but don't sin. It's almost as though Paul's saying, go ahead and be angry, and let's see you try not to sin. Because he tells them later on, just a few verses later, he tells them later on in the context, let all bitterness and wrath, and the word wrath is the same, well, it's not the same word, it's a verb. The other one up, or it's a noun, and up above it's a verb. Let all that pass away from you. So if Paul's really telling them that they ought to get angry, and I have justified being angry several times with Ephesians 4:26. Righteous anger. Jesus Christ had righteous anger, but he was the God-man, and he didn't have a sin nature to contend with. I'm not the God-man, and I have a sin nature to contend with, and I go down that path, and I don't know when to stop. See? So it's not an option for me. Now, the reason is, see, you get this thing. I want to do this, and I want to do this. I want to love a brother, which Paul says in Galatians 6, by bearing a burden, by going and trying to help and correct. And on the same time, I've got this thing over here where I don't want to cause a problem. And I want to exercise self-control. And it's this conflict back and forth, knowing, how do I do that? See, now, this is what we're saying about God's holiness. God's never in that position. I read theologies where there are people, and I'm not saying real good theologians, I don't see this in, but people that are kind of sloppy with their theologies, I've heard pastors and read theologies where they'll say, God had to set aside his righteousness in order to love us. Baloney. God has never set aside at any time any aspect of his character so that he could do another aspect of his character. God doesn't do that. Because that would be holiness. That would be lacking holiness. That means that two aspects of his character are in conflict. And God is never in conflict. There's never a conflict between his love and his righteousness. Which people say, God loved us so much, he had to set aside his holiness. He had to put his holiness over here. He set his righteousness over here. Baloney. You're saying God is a God that was in conflict and he had to choose between this attribute and this attribute. And he never does that. Now when he's saying here, in verse 12, the one who is my God, the Holy One, the one that is, this is the other aspect of holiness, that in time, he's then the God that's unique. There's nothing else like him in this way. He set apart that there is no other one. Because all the other gods, false gods, they're always wrestling. They're in conflict. You go and read history of gods, and I grew up in third grade. All of third grade reading for me was Greek mythology. So I got to read about, of course, Greek mythology, we did it under Roman mythology, technically, but it was as the Greeks, as it was Venus and Mars and Jupiter and all these gods and reading. And it was all really fascinating as third grade reading about it. I all knew it was a bunch of baloney. They didn't brainwash me in the least. It was all fiction to me because I knew who God was. And I knew this was crummy. But you know, the thing you learn about that is those people, their false gods did what? They fought and bickered among each other.
They acted like people.
They acted like people. Because what did you do? They made gods that were like themselves. Just tougher. Okay? They could kill each other, but they couldn't be killed by mortals. So when you're talking about God here and you're saying, the one who is, my God, the Holy One, the one who is uniquely set apart, he's not, there's nothing else like him. But it, from eternal perspective, he's also the one that there's never a conflict. Now this is what, this is important for you to get. He's looking at what God's going to do in bringing the Chaldeans against his people, and he has to say, you are a God in which there is never a conflict, and you are always existing. Because for Habakkuk, he's going to ask a question in just a second. Keep this in mind now. He's going to ask a question in just a little bit a second. Because of who you are, God, how can you do this? But by remembering that he's a holy God, he knows there's no conflict in you in doing what you're going to do. So then he goes on from there. And he's going to say, this is what you've done now, this Holy One. Number one, we're not going to die. In other words, you're not, and I think he's talking about later on what we looked at later on, probably the, one of the most well-known Old Testament verses, verse 4 of chapter 2, the righteous one will live by his faith, which is quoted several or, four times in the New Testament, three times in the New Testament. That statement, it really relates to this idea that he's confident we won't die. You're bringing this nation to punish us, but you're not bringing him here just to kill us all. There were going to be people that were going to die because there were going to be people that wouldn't cooperate. Now, the last thing he says in verse 12, you are a rock. What do you think of when you think of a rock? Why in the world would you
sturdy,
call God?
Sturdy and heavy and hard to move.
Yeah. Yeah. You're talking about a rock that is, you can depend on the fact that it's there and you're going to come back and it's going to be there. We're not talking about a stone. We're talking about something you kick down the road. Yeah, we're talking about a rock. We're talking about God being something that you can count on. We're talking about God being something you can build on. And as he looks at this, he says, oh, rock, he's looking at you are the one that is stable. You're the one that I would anchor myself to. You are the one that I'm going to find stability in when everything else is going crazy here. And he says at the end of this, you, O rock, have literally stood or established them to correct. Now, this word that he uses here to correct, to distinguish what he means here, in verse 12, where he says in the middle of the verse, you have appointed them to judge, and at the end of the verse, you, O rock, have established them to correct. That word correct, the difference between judge and correct at the end. Judge is simply the word mishpat. It means to render a judgment. But the word correct here is a word that probably is somewhat closely akin to our New Testament word to reprove. Now, the difference between reproving and judgment is reproving is causing a person to see the facts for what they are. It's what the Holy Spirit does with an unsaved person to bring them to the point that they'll believe the gospel. That they have to see, wait a second, I don't believe in Jesus Christ. I thought I believed in him, but I don't believe in him. And I don't have righteousness, and he does. I lack the very righteousness he has. And if I go out of this world not believing him and without that righteousness, I will be judged like the prince of the world. And the Spirit convinces, he makes those facts real to him. You can stand all day long to a person and try to prove those things to them, and if the Spirit doesn't do it, they're not going to see it. They're going to, yeah, I believe in Jesus. You go and talk to any Mormon, they're going to say, oh, I believe in Jesus. Oh, and I've got righteousness from God, and I won't be judged. They're confident of those things. Because in reality, the Holy Spirit, if they're unsaved, hasn't yet convinced them of their lack of real faith in who Jesus is, and their lack of real righteousness, and the fact that they will face judgment. And so that is what he means when he uses this. Some examples of this. Out of the Old Testament, I'm just going to give them to you. We're not going to turn these passages, but in Genesis 21 and 25, Abraham has to go and reprove Abimelech because Abimelech's servants have seized a well and are not letting Abraham's men have access to the well to water their flocks. and he has to go and reprove and say, listen, this is a well that belongs to everybody. You have no right to seize it and make it uniquely your own. Is this something, in other words, it'd be like coming and saying, is this something that you have uniquely owned yourself that hasn't belonged, it hasn't been owned by or used by people at large? So that would be proving a case, isn't it? You're bringing out the facts and you're saying, historically, you know that this hasn't been the way it is. So there's a reproof in there. It's used twice in Genesis 24 with the servant that Abraham sends to find a wife for Isaac. And the servant, remember, goes up there and he goes, as he's traveling, he's going, this is going to be hard. How in the world am I going to know who to get, who's the right girl for Isaac? How am I going to know? So he goes to God and he says, this is the way I want you to do it, God. I'm going to go there and you're going to, uses this word, she's going to be proved to me by the fact that she not only will draw water for me, but she'll draw water when she comes to water. She'll also draw water for my animals that had traveled with him. Because remember, brought a lot of animals because there were all kinds of gifts that Abraham sent. And when that actually happens, when she comes out, what does the servant say? You were proved to me, or she was proved to me by this. So there was concrete facts. You can lay the evidence out there. This is what I asked. God, this is how I want to know the right one. I want to prove that she's the right one because I want this to happen. And when he knows she's the right one and he goes in to talk to her brother Laban, he says, this is how I knew. So two times he uses that word to reprove. Well, what he's saying here is, these in verse 12, you, O rock, you have established them to correct, or that is to provide reproof. They're here to show us what we've done wrong. And they're going to do that because their bad behavior is going to be magnified when they're under the gun. There are going to be people that are going to do right under the gun, and there are going to be people that when they're under the gun, they are worse. I was just talking in the mom's Bible study yesterday morning. We were talking about the tribulation period and how in the tribulation period, as you come out the end, Denali had a number of questions about how the tribulation period works out in the millennial kingdom as you were going out. So we were talking about this at the end. And in the tribulation period, when God judges the Jews at the end of the tribulation, and when God judges the Gentiles and the sheep and the goats at the end of the tribulation, he judges both of them. We're really knocked out of our senses by this, but he judges them on the basis of their works. People go into the kingdom based on the fact that they did this unto the least of these, my brethren. And there are people that go into fire prepared for the devil and his angels because they didn't do this to the least of these, my brethren. We go, are they saved by grace or are they saved by works? They're saved by grace and they're saved by faith, but he can demonstrate their works because the intensity of the pressure, the adversity that's going to happen during the tribulation is so intense, it is so severe, that it really is going to cause the selfishness of the world that Paul tells us in Romans 2 that you and I can't perceive all the time. We look at them and they go, they're good people, they're nice people, they're moral people. And Paul says, no, they're not. They are selfish in what they do. God tells us that. You just remember that. When you look at those good people out there, remember, God says they're selfish. And if you put them in a situation where they have to choose between whether they live or you live, they're going to choose themselves. And that's what happens in the tribulation period. And so when the pressure's up and the heat's up, it creates a dividing line so that he can show, you guys wouldn't do any of this. And you did. And they're going to demonstrate their righteousness so much so by the way they live. And their lack of righteousness by how they didn't live. And so that's what's going to happen. And that is what happened when God brought the Chaldeans against Jerusalem. When they put the city under siege, Jeremiah comes to the king. And he says, God said, make peace with this king of Babylon. Go out to him and everything will be fine. And Kai comes up and goes, no way. There is no way that we're going out. And there's plenty of false prophets to say, no, you don't go out to the king. And remember, the one king was such a stinker that what Nebuchadnezzar ended up doing with him at the end when they finally took the city, takes all of his, what did he have, seven sons? Brought his seven sons in front of him, killed every one of those sons in front of the king, and then poked his eyes out so that the last thing he saw was his sons being killed. And the rest of his life, in prison with his eyes poked out, the last thing that the image burned in his mind is the death of his sons there. Because he refused to do what Jeremiah said and go out to the king of Babylon. Their rebellion against God intensified when the pressure was on at the Chaldeans, and it proved who they were. But on the other hand, it's going to prove who the righteous ones were, because the righteous ones, according to 2:4, are going to live by their faith. So let's move on. Here then comes his problem, reminding himself that the God who is, the God who is holy and is not in conflict, he's going to bring up now what Habakkuk sees as a conflict. And he's going to ask this question. Okay. Verse 13. Now, notice the New American Standard, they put thine or your eyes, yours are in italics. It just says, because he's still talking to the God. He hasn't really broken this off. Eyes too pure to, New American Standard says approve, literally to look on, or we'd say look on with favor, to look on evil. You are not capable to look on wickedness. And that word wickedness at the end of this that he uses, flip my page here, the end of this when he talks about this wickedness, sorry, I've got to go look at my other notes here because I can't remember. Yeah, the last one that he uses here for wickedness is literally, it's a word that means misery, that or trouble that causes misery. Okay? In other words, some people go through trouble and it doesn't cause misery, but this is talking about trouble that comes on and causes absolute total misery. Now, what's going to happen when the Chaldeans come against Jerusalem is not only going to cause trouble, but it's going to cause absolute misery to these people. They're just going to be in terrible, horrible, miserable straits. And they are going to undergo evil. And remember what the word evil means. It does not mean sinister. It does not mean vile. It does not mean cruel. It means calamity or disaster. It's what Adam and Eve were tempted with in the garden, where God gave them the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that most people don't know what that means. But it meant the tree that would give you the knowledge of what would make for contentment, sense of well-being and happiness, versus what would make for calamity, disaster, and misery. It's not morality versus immorality. Righteousness versus unrighteousness. That's the way we take it, because we take good and evil to be righteous versus unrighteous. And that is not what was meant by those terms. And what Satan tempted Adam with is, you can have the ability to figure out what will make you happy without God, and what will make you unhappy without God. And after he ate the fruit, he found out, oh yeah, I know what would make me happy, having not ate the fruit, but I can't undo that now. And eating the fruit brings misery, and I can't do anything about it. So God's the one that has to take care of relieving the misery. And that's when you bring in another aspect of God's character, temporal aspect of his character called mercy. Because God then wants that goodness. See, they could have the knowledge of good and evil. Goodness, mercy, is an expression of God's goodness, where he's going to alleviate or relieve misery, suffering, and pain that we brought on ourselves. God could stand over in the corner and cross his arms and tap his toe and say, you brought it on yourself, boy. You take care of it. You suffer. You bit the sour grapes. You suffer. But he doesn't do that. And his mercy makes possible for us to actually have that pain and the suffering alleviated. In terms of salvation for Israel. So this is what he's talking about. He says, your eyes are too pure to approve of that which is calamitous. And by the way, the Old Testament tells us God causes evil. He causes calamity because he uses calamity for judgment. And it's not God's, there's not a conflict with that. God can still be a content and happy God and bring calamity on people because it's what they brought on themselves, and he's using it to make a point and to achieve something that pertains to his happiness and goodness. You and I don't know how to do that. Probably the closest thing you and I get to as a parent is when you have to take a rebellious child and you have to put him over your knee and you have to give him a little paddle. And you know, that paddle is such a, if you're doing it right as a parent, that paddle connects with them. It smarts a little bit. You're not hurting the child. You're just causing enough to smart to get their attention. And they don't like it. It makes them uncomfortable for a while. They cry. They may cry quite a bit over it. But it's that old saying, for you. Now, this doesn't happen with God, but for you, it hurts. I had two sweet, cute little girls, and when I had to put those little girls over my knee and do that to them, that hurt horribly to do that. So God doesn't have that problem. Because in my mind, I have to keep telling myself, while this child is crying, I want this child to be happy down the road. And if this this behavior is not nipped in the bud, this child is going to be one of those kids that Ben's going to be calling me up going, we need to have a conference, Mr. Holsch. We've got a problem kid here. And I'm sure Ben sees a lot of kids like that at school. And if they don't get taken care of at his level, then they end up seeing Jim at the emergency room up there. Kids that their parents have not nipped it in the bud, parents have made excuses for it, because the parent can't see enough to realize that for the ultimate happiness and good of this child, this needs to end. See, but God can see that. And so God can actually discipline us, not only out of love, but he can discipline us with a sense of goodness or well-being, knowing that he's actually accomplishing something that will, in the end, bring about a happy end. As you have over in the book of Hebrews in chapter 12, for us, the chastening isn't fun while you're going through it, but in the end, it brings about the peaceable fruit consisting of righteousness. There are things I don't do today because my dad disciplined me when I was a kid. He drilled those things out of me, that behavior. See? And there's some people that never get that drilled out of them. So here in Hebrews, God does not have a conflict when he brings calamity on people. But Habakkuk is struggling with, your eyes are so pure, God. How can you do this? See, because from a human point of view, we wrestle with this. We can't make sense of how can a good God and a righteous God use evil to accomplish his purpose. We don't get it. Because we get so focused in the moment, we have a tough time looking beyond this immediate struggle. And because we also lack omniscience, we have a tough time seeing what the outcome's going to be. And God doesn't have that problem. God knows what the outcome is going to be. He's planned the outcome. It's not just that he knows it because he can see how it's going to turn out. He's actually planned it. You and I, I don't want to sound like a horrible parent, but there were times when with one of our daughters, because she'd go through a kind of rebellious stage, that you thought, you're going to spank this kid all every day. And you're thinking, I'm going to turn into an abusive parent here. If this child doesn't get it, I mean, you'd actually, this would run through my mind, and I'd worry about this at times. Because this is never going to get turned around. I don't know. Maybe none of the rest of you ever felt like that, but I think as a parent, I think it's a good thing to be concerned and say, I don't want it to go that far. Because it's one of the things that keeps it in check. Which then goes on in verse 13, in the middle of the verse, then he says, why then do you look with favor on those who deal, this word treacherously, it's a word, those who cheat. And he's talking about the Chaldeans. He looked at them as treacherous, deceitful cheaters. Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? Now I think we have a question. Is he talking about his own people? I don't think so, because that was what he addressed early on. Now he's looking at God bringing the Chaldeans in, and he's going to go, wow, the Chaldeans? They're going to be brought in? That fierce, wicked people? They're going to swallow up those who definitely are more righteous. In other words, was Habakkuk going to suffer under what the Chaldeans were going to do? Yeah. Was Jeremiah going to suffer to some degree under this? Yes. All these righteous people were going to suffer. In fact, I'm trying to remember. It's Jeremiah is the one, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Jeremiah, because I think we were just reading it, Jeremiah is the one that tells us on at least two occasions that even if, and he names, what are the people he names? Daniel, right? Is it Daniel? Anyway. But he names three people in history. It's Joshua, Daniel, and is it Job? You should remember this, Jim. You went through Job. That he mentions that even if they were there, they would not by their righteousness be able to deliver the people. And I think it's Joshua, Daniel, and Job. In other words, righteous people that in the face of opposition went ahead and did the right thing.
Noah,
that's what it was. Noah. Yeah, because God brought judgment in Noah's day, despite the fact that Noah was the only righteous one. And Job, apparently the only righteous one around, really. His friends certainly weren't. And Daniel gets carted off. Apparently, his righteousness couldn't deliver him. And so when he looks at this, there were going to be there were righteous people at times that had to go through a lot of different things. Had to experience that. Think of what Job experienced and what God was demonstrating about righteousness in that context and what Daniel had experienced. So then we go on then to verse 14. Why then have you made men like fish of the sea, like it creeping things without a ruler over them? In other words, he looks at them as just these animals. Fish in the sea, what do? You throw that. We always think of casting the pole out like this and you let it and catch it. But when he's talking about fish in the sea without a ruler, it's like casting a net in to draw in a big draw of fish. Or I think I told some of you this. This summer, my dad and I had to haul a bunch of stuff to a transfer station, a bunch of construction debris. And as we're taking it to the transfer station, it was a torrential downpour. And we got out down in this one place on Highway 3 where we're driving, and there were salamanders all over the road. They were crawling. They were going from south to north all over. Like they had no king. They're just all just crossing out there, getting run over and all this stuff. He says, this is his question. Why have you made men like this? Because this is the way he sees that we're just fish out there to be caught. We're just like creeping things made to be caught. The Chaldeans, they bring all them up with a hook, or they drag them away with their net. They gather them together in their fishing net, and therefore they rejoice and are glad. In other words, the Chaldeans are glad because they throw their net in and they take people like we take fish in a net. He says, why, God? Why is it this way? See, he's wrestling. Habakkuk is wrestling. You can understand why the first of this book called it a burden, or they translate New American Standard an oracle, but a burden. It was a weight on him to stop and think, God, I don't get this. Verse 16, therefore they offer a sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their fishing net, because through these things their catch is large, their food is plentiful. Will they therefore empty their net and continually slay nations without sparing? In other words, you don't have fishermen that say, oh, we caught a net full, let's go home. No, they empty the net and go back and catch more. And he says, that's the way the Chaldeans are, God. And they offer and they worship the very thing that they catch people with. So the Chaldeans worship gods that essentially he's looking at were gods of their warfare. Gods for their chariot and their horsemen and their swords. And with this, then, God's going to give, beginning in chapter 2, he's going to give Habakkuk five woes, okay? Five woes that he starts off with in here. And so we're going to start putting in, we're not going to get in the woes till we get down to verse 6, and I think we're going to save the woes for next week, so we'll go down through there. We'll look at this introduction to the woes with what we said. So he says in verse 1 of chapter 2, I will stand on my guard post and station myself on my rampart, and I will keep watch to see what he will speak to me. In other words, I've asked my questions. I first cried out, God, I want justice. God says, okay, I'll give you justice. I'm bringing the Chaldeans against your people. Wait a second, God. You are so holy. Your eyes are so pure. You're the one that is existing. How can you look with any kind of favor on these horrible people punishing these people? We're bad, but they're worse. And so he says, now I'm going to stand on my rampart and I'm going to wait for God to answer me. I'm going to stand up there. So you're talking about like a guard going up on the wall on his guard post, watching for the enemy to see what's going to happen. He says, I'm going to stand up there and I'm going to wait how I may reply when I am reproved. Now notice that. He says, I'm going to be reproved. You're going to, I know, God, you're going to explain this to me. You're going to lay your case out. You're going to help me see what I don't get here. Anyway, we'll stand track. Verse 2. Then the Lord answered me and said, record the vision. Inscribe it on tablets. Notice he says on tablets. He doesn't say write it down on vellum. Doesn't say put it on parchment. I don't know if they had they would have parchment back then. I don't know if they had papyrus as paper. To my knowledge, at this time, most of what they wrote on were animal skins that were tied or dried and tanned and everything like that. Vellum is what they were using, or parchment like that. But here, this is going to be on that. This is going to be on tablets. Tablets meaning that planks is the word tablets. Simple. Tablets is the way they translate here, but literally planks. So it's like taking big chunks of board, something that seems like it's got a lot of stability to it. Something's going to last, and you're going to write this now on boards. Very likely this is what it is, because it's the word for planks. The one who reads it, they run. You can read it and go, the Chaldeans are coming. Let's get out. The very thing, remember, that Jeremiah says, the Chaldeans, go out. Don't stay in the city. And the king in Jerusalem is going, stay in the city. We're not going out to him. And his false prophets are going, he'll go away. He'll give up and go away. That's what the false prophets kept saying. Verse 3, for the vision is yet for the appointed time. It hastens toward the goal, and it will not fail. In other words, this vision that I've given you, Habakkuk, it's going to happen. Because there are going to be all kinds of people that are going to say otherwise. And all you have to do is go back and read Jeremiah, and you can see all the... In fact, they got so mad with Jeremiah that what did they do? They stuck him down in a cistern so that he was up to mud up to his armpits in there. Because they didn't like him. There were people that actually... He was actually saved on one occasion because there were people that wanted to kill him. Because they so disliked what he said. We have kings like that. Remember, in Ahab's day, Ahab was the king of Israel, and the king of Judah was, starts with a J, and it's one of the longer. Jehoshaphat. Thank you, Ben. Jehoshaphat. Yeah. And they come up, and Ahab and Jehoshaphat are dealing with an army like that. And they're trying to decide what to do, whether they should go out to battle. And Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, goes, well, don't you have a prophet? All prophets are all saying this. Don't you have any other prophets of God? And Ahab said, well, yeah, I've got this other prophet around here, Elijah. He says, but all Elijah does, he always tells me bad things. I don't like to listen to him. See? You imagine being so foolish that all you do is surround yourself with yes men? People that are always going to tell you what, yes, it's going to be a great day. Oh, it's going to be wonderful. Wouldn't you like that if you got on your computer in the morning and checked the weather and it said, hey, 60 degrees today and sunny. You go outside and go, it's not 60 degrees, but my computer tells me it's going to be 60 and sunny. See? You can surround yourself with people that lie to you all you want. It doesn't change the facts. Well, that's what was going to happen here. It goes on there in verse 3 and says, though it tarries, wait for it. In other words, it's going to seem like there's going to be a little bit of a wait here, but wait for it. It's going to come. For it will certainly come. It will not delay. Then we come to verse 4 again that we looked and now seeing it in its context. Behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him. And that word right there is, it is not straight or level. It's crooked. It's bent. I have in my shed, I have a framing square. It's bent. You can use it for one thing, but the normal thing you do with framing squares, you can't use it for. Because of the bent in it, it doesn't work right. Okay? And that's what he's looking at. It says that one, his soul in him is not right. It's not square. It's not straight. Meaning, he's never going to, you wouldn't expect him, you wouldn't trust him to give you a right thing. Could you imagine having built a house? Ben and Lindsay built their house there. Could you imagine if the contractors the whole time had using transits that were messed up and their levels were messed up and their framing squares were messed up? You wouldn't have a nice house. Everything would be all crooked. Everything would be all out of whack. He says, but that's the way the soul of this man is, the proud, the haughty man. His soul. So he's never going to see it right. So when this prophecy of these people are going to come, because his soul is crooked and bent and twisted, he's not going to respond right. He's not going to obey what God is going to say through people like Habakkuk and through Jeremiah. They're not going to listen and obey God. They're going to go, no, we can stick it out. We can wait it out. Nebuchadnezzar will go away. Because their soul isn't right. Everybody gets that? And so as a result of that, and then in contrast, he says, but the righteous one will live by his faith. What's his faith going to be in? It's going to be in the promise of God. And what's the promise of God? God is going to bring this nation here. And he is going to use this nation. And you're going to direct faith in this and say, God promised he's going to bring this nation here to punish us for our unrighteousness. And therefore, I'm not going to push against what God's trying to do. I'm going to cooperate. I'm going to be in agreement with what God's trying to do here. Yes?
Those people that are righteous because they're believing, yes, these people are coming in just like what you said, and God's going to do all this. Is there any part of that promise where those people who believe all that are delivered? Or, are they...
I think that's what he actually, I think that's what he's getting at back in verse 12, and he says, are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, the Holy One, we will not die. See, if they would just take the punishment they were supposed to take. In fact, you know what God told Israel through Jeremiah? Go to Babylon. Do not seek ill for that city. Do not pray against that city. Go there and seek the peace of Babylon. Build homes there, get married there, have kids there, and just wait it out. That's in Jeremiah. And that's what God was telling these people to do. And these people are, there's no way we're going to Babylon. I am not going to do this. And God says, you know what, just go to Babylon. I'll bless you in Babylon. You'll be fine in Babylon. You'll be healthy. You'll eat well. You'll have houses. You'll get married. You'll have kids. But if you stay here and you fight against this, it's going to be bad, and it's just going to get ugly.
So, I'm not going to... What is that righteous person supposed to do?
Well, so the righteous person... So the righteous person is not going to try to work contrary to... He's not going to resist God's prophecy. He's not going to stand there and go, no, God isn't going to judge us, which is exactly what
basically
the false prophet...
Basically saying that God's... And God brings another power. Say, yes, sir. Over
yeah.
The power of the...
Yeah.
Basically, first Peter.
No, what? Okay, you got to ask the question.
God's what? I'm not going to resist God's what?
God's will. We'll just put it God's will. Okay. Now let me just state one other thing about we went over this the night we introduced Habakkuk because we looked at those places where Habakkuk 2:4 is quoted in the New Testament. Paul quotes it in Galatians. He quotes it in Romans, and he quotes it in Hebrews. And Martin Luther based his idea of justification by faith on this verse. Okay? Although you need to understand something, and having not read a lot of what Luther said on this, we may miss Luther's point. Because Luther's contention between himself and the Catholic Church was not strictly about whether or not a person initially gets saved by grace through faith. It's whether or not a person is eternally secure and goes on by grace through faith. Because the Catholic Church does not believe in eternal security. Because if you believe in eternal security, then they don't have a way to keep control of you. Okay? And Luther based his statement on this, that the just shall live by faith, that see they are righteous by faith. But that is not what verse 4 is saying. And it is not what Paul quotes in the New Testament when he quotes this three times. What he's saying is, the righteous one lives by faith. If you're righteous, you're going to be living by faith. That's what you're going to do. Now, he's not saying righteous in your position in Christ. He's talking about practical righteous. The one that is practically righteous, that is doing practical righteousness in his Christian life, is going to do so by faith. Which is exactly what Paul's point is when he gets to Galatians 5, is that we are those who by faith are expecting the hope consisting of righteousness. And that hope of righteousness is the ability to actually love other people. Remember, in the present dispensation of grace, what's your righteous activity? First and foremost, it's acts of love for others. That's your righteousness. in practice. Your positional righteousness is in Christ. But you actually have the ability to, and that's what he's talking about. He's talking about practical righteousness here. This person, the practical righteousness that people would live out would be by faith. That righteous person is going to do that. They're going to do what God wants rather than resist. But then he comes to verse... No, we're going to stop there because verse 5... We're going to stop there because verse 5 actually is a lead in for the woes. I want to make sure I catch this right. Okay? And I don't want to jump into... I don't want to jump into tackling the woes. I think I'd like to kind of try to go through all the woes in one evening. So, what? Oh, you're talking about something else. Oh, woes. Okay. So let me mark where we end, and then let's go back and see, for those that see if you were able to answer these questions or if you need help with these. So we flip back over to page 1. We were down at the bottom. We saw last week, we ended with verse 1, 7 through 11, how did God characterize this nation, that they were dreaded, that they were their own authority, they were fast, they mocked rulers. We saw that. Now we pick up tonight with 1:12. What did Habakkuk know about this coming nation? According to 1:12. What?
They would kill all of Judah.
They wouldn't kill all of Judah. Okay, that's not what I put down, but that is definitely one of the things he knew. Yeah. The other thing was, he knew God was going to use them to judge and correct his nation. He knew they were an instrument of judgment and correction. That's what he knew. Okay. Now, then we come to verse 13. What was Habakkuk's struggle with God's revelation to him?
Understanding his character.
Yeah. Trying to put together from a human perspective God's pure and holy character with this calamity that was going to be coming on his nation. He couldn't do those.
His holiness, suffering.
Yeah. I'll read you my answer I wrote out. And I may read this and go, what did I say? But it's, I wrote out, how could a pure God use such a vile and violent nation that treated men and nations like so many fish in the sea to catch in their net? That's the way I summarize it. You don't have to summarize it. That's just the way I summarized it. How could he use a nation that was so vile and violent that they just treated nations like just so many fish in the ocean to be caught? Now that brings us then to verse 3. And the question then is, was the vision to be taken literally? That is the vision of this coming people.
Yeah,
it was to be taken literally. Why? Because God said, it's going to come. It won't delay. Told them that. It's going to come. Don't think that just because there's a little hesitation, because it doesn't come right away tomorrow, that it's not coming. In fact, remember, when Habakkuk's writing this, we are getting right down to the end. We talked last week about Egypt, remember, going up to help the Chaldeans at the Battle of Carchemish against the Assyrians, and the Assyrians, the Egyptians going up to help the Assyrians against the Babylonians in the Battle of Carchemish. And when Carchemish falls to the Babylonians head south and they come down into Judea in 605. It falls. And so we're probably right around 605 when this is happening.
We
don't know for sure, but we know that Habakkuk knows who the Chaldeans are, which he would have known because the Chaldeans were doing battle with the Assyrians and the Egyptians up north. So we're right around 605 BC. And in that same year, they're going to come down against Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is going to fall to them.
So they're going to be overtaken in a year.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the last thing, verse 4. List the two individuals who would hear Habakkuk's prophecy, and what is the response of each one? What are the two individuals?
The righteous and then
the righteous and the proud. And how does the proud respond?
Don't
listen. Because his soul, remember, is not straight. So he can't get an accurate reading. He's never going to respond right. What's the righteous one to do?
Believe God's promise.
He's going to believe God's promise. And as a result, he's going to live. And remember when we talked about live? What does he mean when he says he lives by faith? What's the significance of live?
He lives.
He's going to live, literally. He's going to physically preserve his life by believing God's promise. He's going to live through this. And there were people. There were people that lived through everything that the Babylonians did because they obeyed, because they did what God wanted. Jeremiah lived through it. Ezekiel lived through it. Daniel and his friends lived through it. So there were people that lived through this.
It's not like the king was kind of kind to Jeremiah even, or showed him well, relatively speaking.
Yeah, his general, he did show kindness to Jeremiah. Because I think he came to understand that Jeremiah actually had been encouraging the people to not resist. Exactly. Now, if there's something for you and I think, to take away out of this, it's for the fact that even you and I sometimes struggle with the character of God and the things that we see. Don't we? I mean, is there anybody in here that's immune from this? Is there any of you that don't wrestle sometimes with, I know who God is, and this is hard to watch? I do that. But I think, like Habakkuk, what we do is when we come to God and we develop a good theology of who God is, and then we watch that, and we know God's promises with regard to us or regard to specific other situations or other people, it gives us the ability to kind of keep doing what we're supposed to be doing in those things so that we can direct those when we can't put it together. Like I was telling you, an example. I watch some of my friends and some of the way they act in this, and I, in my mind, I don't know how God handles it. I don't know how God does it. And then I kind of think about it a while, and it kind of occurs to me, you know, God's pretty merciful and long-suffering with them, and boy, I'm glad, because boy, I tell you, I probably blew it as much as they have, and if he weren't merciful and long-suffering, I would have been out of here a long time ago. So those are kind of some of the things that sometimes we wrestle with, trying to remember who God is. And so any questions here at the end? Anything to add, comment on? Could maybe say the lesson to Habakkuk is watch what you ask for. No, that's not true. Because you just might get it. Exactly. I don't think that's really the point of the book, obviously. But